And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to the moon. In part two, we're going to be meeting a talented hammered dulcimer player who has crafted a brand new Christmas concerto for hammered dulcimer strings and percussion that will receive its world premiere this Saturday night with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra down in Gurnee. And in part three of today's program, something of the great Dr. Seuss. Part one, we talk about a remarkable new book that has just been published by the National Geographic Society in conjunction with the Smithsonian. The book is titled Apollo to the Moon, A History in 50 Objects. The author and editor is Teasel Muir Harmony. And in this wonderful book, we are treated to full-color photographs of 50 different objects, widely varied, that were all in one way or another part of the astonishing story of the Apollo program, which of course ultimately brought human beings all the way to the moon. One of the things you state in the introduction to the book, Apollo to the Moon, A History in 50 Objects, is it would be hard to overstate how unique the Apollo moment was. Explain what you mean by this notion of the Apollo moment and how we, even to this day, do not fully grasp the immensity of it.
There are a few important factors. First, it was the Cold War. And so it's important to remember the Cold War context. And the Soviet Union and the United States were gripped in this very particular type of battle where they were both invested in winning the hearts and minds of the world public and political leaders. And so because of nuclear weapons, it really limited the type of confrontation that was possible. And so there was a sort of added investment in things that could win the hearts and minds of the world. And so space exploration was seen as one of those things. So that's one important factor. Another one is that space exploration had just moved from the realm of science fiction to science fact. And so people had dreamed about exploring the moon for many, many years. But the first satellite didn't go up until 1957. And Project Apollo was proposed in 1961. So it was just a very short amount of time. And when Kennedy proposed Project Apollo, the U.S. had a total of 15 minutes of experience in human spaceflight, so very, very little. So it was this very, very exciting time, and also it was a moment when things like achievements in space were seen as essential elements in the larger grand strategy of Cold War competition. Mm.
I really love how these 50 objects touch on all kinds of different facets of the Apollo experience. Are you responsible for selecting these 50 objects? And if so, what kinds of things did you think about in making these specific selections?
So I am responsible for it, and it was a very difficult job because the Smithsonian has thousands of artifacts and thousands of Apollo-related artifacts. So I'd say half the job of writing the book was just trying to narrow it down to 50. But I really wanted to find a cross-section of material that could tell the technological and scientific elements of the story, but also reveal some of the cultural, political, and social dimensions of Project Apollo as well. So there are lots of great individual stories, and then when they come together, they show this very like three-dimensional program.
Absolutely. And one point that you make is that when one looks at many of these objects, particularly the ones related specifically to the technology, that these are objects that came from all across the country, and we sometimes don't remember, in a sense, sort of the geographical scope of the Apollo project.
Yes, it drew on a workforce in the hundreds of thousands, and a lot of the material that was used is even just off the shelf and then adapted for spaceflight. So Kennedy proposed Project Apollo in 1961, and he said before the end of the decade, and that's a very short timeline, especially since spaceflight was brand new. So it took the work of thousands of people working for thousands of different companies. So 95% of the Apollo workforce are actually contractors working in private industry, and they were scattered across the country, and then there were also people from around the world participating in the program as well.
Right. I want to touch on a few of these specific objects. I want to just briefly mention that the first one, in a remarkable way, ties together Apollo 11 with the first plane flight of the of Orville and Wilbur Wright, but we'll leave it to our listeners to read about that. That's truly wonderful. I want to ask you about the fact that the second object in this book is, in a sense, the picture of an American failure. Explain what this object is and why it is included in this list.
Vanguard TV3 satellite. So this is the first American attempt at launching a satellite. Sputnik was launched by the Soviet Union in October of 1957, and it was seen as a huge blow to American prestige. So a lot of people were surprised that the Soviet Union was first. They anticipated that the U.S. Was going to be the first to launch a satellite, and it seemed to challenge the United States' technological capability and image of national strength. And so we rushed ahead to launch our own satellite that was under development, and unfortunately, the rocket exploded on the launch pad, and this little satellite shows the marks of this explosion. So it never got launched to space. It just sort of rolled next to the launch pad and kept on beeping. But you can see the destruction and the force of the rocket on the satellite in the pictures, and it was covered live by newspaper reporters, and it was called Sputnik and Kaplatnik, and it was seen as yet another blow. So Sputnik was a severe blow to U.S. prestige, and then this failure of the first satellite was another blow. And this is an important part of the space race story and Project Apollo more generally, because the U.S. Was in a position where it felt like it had to catch up, and it had to prove that the country had massive technological capability and the abilities to carry off an impressive space program. Mm. So this was one of the early factors that led to space exploration of the moon.
Right. I want to make sure to ask you about object number four in the book, which is actually two stamps, one mm-hmm. from the United States, one from the Soviet Union, which in a sense helps kind of crystallize the fierce space war in which these two nations were engaged. Briefly tell our listeners about these two stamps and what is intriguing about their design.
I love these stamps because they're such a contrast. The Soviet stamp in celebration of Yuri Gagarin's flight, this is the first human space flight, in April of 1961. And it's a very stylized rocket. It shows a cosmonaut looking up towards the heavens, and it's a sort of has a sense of sort of imagination and exploration. And then the U.S. stamp was actually produced using drawings from NASA and recreating the Mercury spacecraft as accurately as possible. And this was done somewhat secretively so that the stamp could be released as soon as the mission was a success. This is for John Glenn's mission in 1962, the first American orbital spaceflight. But one thing that comes through in these stamps is that the Soviet stamp does not show a real spacecraft, where the United States stamp does. And that demonstrates the contrast and the closeness of the Soviet program and the openness of the U.S. program. So the U.S. would invite reporters to watch launches. It disseminated information about the spacecraft, about the astronauts, things like that. Whereas the Soviet program announced launches and space successes after the fact. You didn't have reporters attending launches, and also the names of cosmonauts were revealed later on after their flights. And so they had a very different approach to the dissemination of information, and it comes across just looking at these two stamps.
Right. It's so interesting to think that they were fearful that somehow helpful information could be gleaned just by looking at a stamp, that would somehow give sensitive information that could be used by enemies in the United States. Very, very intriguing. One of my favorite technology shots among these 50 objects is number 7, when we see the camera that was used by astronaut John Glenn in his historic flight, which was, of course, the first time an American astronaut achieved full orbital flight around the Earth, three times actually. Tell our listeners what is interesting about this camera of John Glenn.
It's a great little camera. So when NASA was preparing for John Glenn's flight, they planned to send a camera up into space, but for scientific experiments. They didn't plan to send a camera to take images of the Earth and space flight for dissemination among the general public. And John Glenn realized that it could be very important to share the experience of space flight more widely. And so he was actually getting his hair cut at a barbershop in Cocoa Beach before his flight. He stopped in at a drugstore, and he saw this camera and bought it off the shelf and had engineers at NASA modify it so that he could use it with his spacesuit on and with his gloves. And he brought it up on his flight, and the pictures he took were really meaningful to people. There was a lot of interest in that. And then after that flight, NASA worked hard to train the astronauts on how to be photographers and take just fantastic images that then were disseminated widely and really are part of our enthusiasm for spaceflight today.
I really appreciate the photograph of the Apollo guidance computer on page 65 of your book, because we take a look at this and we realize it was the best technology of the day, but it looks positively ancient compared to what we think of as a sophisticated computer today. And I suspect that maybe one of the effects we have of looking at many of the objects in this book is that it underscores the fact that this amazing achievement was achieved with technology so much more primitive than what we have today, which in a sense really underscores the extraordinary nature of this success.
And in that essay, I point out that the word software wasn't even used in 1961 when Project Apollo was proposed. 15 minutes of experience in human spaceflight with Alan Shepard's flight, but that's it when Project Apollo was proposed. So the amount of technological development that was necessary, the amount of innovation, and then also managerial information, innovation and building up NASA centers and huge global communications infrastructure. It was an extraordinary undertaking.
I want to also underscore that among these objects are some of the objects that made their way to the moon, including the first meal on the moon. We get to see with our own eyes what sort of food was consumed by the astronauts on the moon. Just say a quick word about this really interesting story.
Yeah, I found that fascinating when I first saw an archival document listing out the first meal on the moon, which you don't always think about, but it is interesting. It makes it sort of more relatable, and you can get a sense of what it was like to be there. But so the astronauts, when they first landed, they had bacon bars and peaches, sugar cookie cubes, coffee, and a pineapple grapefruit drink. And then they did their spacewalk, and then they had a more substantial meal after that. Bacon bars were really popular among the astronauts on the Apollo missions. The favorite food on board in the Apollo program.
We're shown also what the astronauts used to shave, what the astronauts used to exercise, and we're even shown the means by which astronauts were able to relieve themselves and much more. And it just helps us remember that we're talking about human beings and a fully human endeavor, and all that was necessary to make it possible. Explain to our listeners where these objects are housed, and which, if any, of these objects can be viewed in person by the public.
Mm-hmm. So there are a number of places. Right now we have a traveling exhibit called Destination Moon, which focuses on some of the Apollo 11 artifacts that's currently in Pittsburgh, and then its next stop will be in Seattle during the summer of 2019. And we have some artifacts on display at our downtown location of the National Air and Space Museum, and then some out at the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is near Dulles Airport, so the mobile quarantine facility where the Apollo 11 astronauts lived when they first returned from the moon to ensure that there were no space germs that were going to contaminate the Earth. And then we have some in storage, and we have some going through conservation as well. So we're getting ready for a new exhibit on lunar exploration that will open in 2022 called Destination Moon. And so we're getting a lot of artifacts ready to be put back on display in this new exhibit that will open up in a few years.
Well, the book is absolutely wonderful. Again, it's titled A History in 50 Objects, Apollo to the Moon. And it is very thoughtfully written by Teasel Muir Harmony. And there is a foreword written by Michael Collins, who was one of the three astronauts for Apollo 11 and for some years was director of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. And his comments are also very, very noteworthy. So again, this book is published by National Geographic. Teasel Muir Harmony, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed this this book, and I congratulate you on your good work with it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
And for part two of today's morning show, I am very excited to be making the acquaintance of a talented gentleman by the name of Charles Brown, who is going to be in the spotlight this Saturday night with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Ron Arden, who has been on the morning show a number of times before because of his impressive and intriguing musical exploits. This time, Charles Brown is with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra as both soloist and composer in residence. For the next several years, in fact, Charles Brown is going to be serving in that capacity, and a brand new work that he has written for his own musical instrument will be premiered, and that instrument happens to be the hammered dulcimer. So by day, Charles Brown is the CEO of CB3 Financial Group, but by night or in his spare time, he is a very fine hammered dulcimer player and composer as well. And we're going to be talking with him for the next few minutes about the hammered dulcimer, how Charles Brown came to love this instrument, and his own musical background and experience that brings him to this place now where he is crafting wonderful works like this Christmas Concerto for hammered dulcimer, strings, and percussion, which, as I said, receives its world premiere Saturday evening when the Lake County Symphony performs at Village Church down in Gurnee, Illinois. Charles Brown, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here. Appreciate that intro. That was wonderful.
Well, I'm excited to speak with you more about especially the hammered dulcimer, which is such a beautiful instrument and one that is, in a sense, enjoying a little more prominence maybe now, or prominence beyond where it is typically heard. First of all, let's get a little bit of a sketch of who you are, and in particular, your very interesting musical background, which did not begin with the hammered dulcimer. Tell our listeners where your musical life sort of began.
Sure. Well, I started very young, interested to be a rock drummer. I mean, much to the chagrin of my parents, that's what I wanted to be. Listening to rock and roll in the 60s and 70s was good enough to actually get to the Cincinnati Conservatory, which is where I did my college training as a percussion major. And stayed in that and actually ended up writing music for TV commercials in Cincinnati, and then later built recording studios in Chicago as well. So I had a particular bent for commerce as well. My father was a businessman, so it was a mixture of music and business that got me started. But, early on, mostly on timpani, I played Carnegie Hall and the Kennedy Center on that instrument with a youth orchestra and actually toured Europe. But I listened to a band in the 90s headed by Rich Mullins, who had brought this instrument called the hammered dulcimer. And even though I'd been a lifelong percussionist, I wasn't familiar with it because, for the most part, the instrument is contained in the Appalachian part of the country. Many of the artists that play it are there. But he brought the instrument to the recorded word, and, man, it was just amazing to hear it when I did.
Mm. And so that's what sort of piqued your interest. Somewhere on your website, you describe the hammered dulcimer as both a string and a percussion instrument, which right there makes it sound like something quite out of the ordinary. For someone who's never been up close to a hammered dulcimer, and especially for someone who's never actually watched a hammered dulcimer being played, explain what it looks like and how it is played.
Sure. So a piano is a percussion instrument as well, and string, because it incorporates both pieces. So if you can think of a harp, I mean, many people can visualize a person playing a harp and striking it with their fingers. Turn the harp sideways, put it on a stand, and grab two sticks, which we'll call hammers, and hit the notes with those hammers. And that's essentially what's going on with a hammered dulcimer, although there are metal strings on a hammered dulcimer, as opposed to, you know, nylon on a harp. But that's the nature of the instrument. It actually dates all the way back to 1100 BC in Persia. And then it was picked up in, as I said earlier, the Appalachian part of the U.S., where it blended well with what's known as the lap dulcimer. A lot of people know that instrument, just a few strings on it, and plays simple melodies. But you add fiddles and other stringed instruments, and that's where you get the folk sound of America. But actually, the instrument hails much, much earlier than all of those instruments. And this fellow, Rich Mullins, brought this to the pop music world in the 80s and 90s. And once I heard it, I decided, well, gee, it's a percussion instrument. I ought to learn how to play this. So
how did you go about doing that? I mean, did you seek out a teacher, or at least in the beginning, were you, in a sense, largely self-taught? How did you pursue the notion of learning how to play this instrument?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, I was had to learn by fire, because this fellow, Rich Mullins, shortly after I heard him play this live and on many recordings, was killed in an auto accident. And about a year later, some friends of mine said, you know, we really should do something to honor this man, and so let's do a concert. Let's go on, put together a tour and go to local churches and perform his music. Well, you can't play Rich Mullins' music without at least some of the songs on which he played hammer dulcimer. So I actually bought one in the summer of 1998, and 3 months later started this little tour. So I that was, I guess, trial by fire. I was entirely self-taught, but being a percussionist gives you a head start, because, after all, you're hitting it with sticks, also known as hammers, and you learn the melodies, and pretty much go from there.
Wow, very good. By the way, some of our listeners who might possibly know a little bit about contemporary Christian music might know the name Rich Mullins, or maybe not recognize the name, but might know his most famous composition, which is the song Awesome God. And
yes,
he composed a lot of things for people like Amy Grant and other very, very important singers in that particular field.
Exactly, and, yes.
So anyway, did you ever end up pursuing study with a teacher, or is pretty much your mastery of the hammered dulcimer of your own development?
Well, in the beginning, I did not. I learned it enough to play for the what we call the Rich Memories Tour in the 90s. But then recently, when I decided to really make that my focus, as I entered middle age, I said, maybe I should spend a little bit more time with this seriously. And so I found a fellow named Joshua Messick, who is probably the preeminent player. There are only, from our estimates, maybe 6 to 10 people in America making a living playing this instrument, and Joshua is one of them. Joshua, this year, was hired to compose and perform on music for a feature film that was done in Japan. They flew him over there. He's actually on tour now, going all over the central part of America playing Christmas concerts. So Joshua helped me with my technique, with how to strike the instrument, he actually has a technique where he plucks the strings, to give a different variety of sounds. So that helped me just tremendously as we developed how to treat the instrument with the orchestra for this Christmas concerto.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking on this portion of the morning show with Charles Brown. And Charles Brown is going to be performing with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night, performing in what will amount to the world premiere of his Christmas concerto for hammer, dulcimer, strings, and percussion. And we are speaking with him about his musical career and about to learn a little more about this particular undertaking. So you mentioned earlier that your background included some work in writing music for commercials and that sort of thing. But as I recall from reading your biography, you kind of set aside the whole composition thing for a while. At what point did you start taking up composition again? Was it roughly the same time that you took up the hammer dulcimer, or more recently than that?
I would say it was more recently than that. So I am a portfolio manager. We have clients in 14 states, and I'm, you know, very involved in that business. But at some point, I just realized that I had missed the musical side of my existence, so to speak, and became interested in writing music for Christmas time on that instrument. It's an instrument that is very indicative of sounds and the mystery of Christmas. So I composed this piece for the Moody Church, where I'm a percussionist in downtown Chicago. And Ron Arden heard this piece that I did last Christmas Eve and said, you know, we want to do that at our orchestra's concert in 2018. And so I said, well, that'd be wonderful. I'd like to do that. A couple months later, Greg, he said, you know, why don't you write a piece for orchestra with the hammer dulcimer? He said, is that something that you'd want to do? And I said, I'd be thrilled to. So spent the better part of this year coming up with different ideas, timbres, and themes to do exactly that.
The piece, I've heard kind of a computerized version of it, not quite the real thing, but it gives us a very, very good sense of it, is beautifully constructed. And the major melodic material of it derives from the carol God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Did you look around a long time before finally settling on that as being the primary melodic source, or did you try out a bunch of different things before finally settling on that? And is there something in particular about God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen that made it, in a sense, especially fertile ground for a work like this?
You know, that's a great question. The first movement, first of all, there are four movements. So Father, Son, Spirit, and Savior. Those are four characteristics of God. And so I wanted to present those four characteristics at the birth of God, or the birth of Christ. And so actually in a band, we did a rock and roll version of God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. And so the theme and the rhythms that I incorporated in here were taken from that was done 25 years ago. So people will probably be surprised. They think of Christmas as light and airy. And, we've treated three of these four pieces with pretty big, aggressive sounds. And then the third movement, based on Low Hour Rose Here Blooming, is sort of the relief to that. But what we're trying to do is present carols with which people are familiar, but in a way that gives them time to have reflective moments, but also to just hear and experience the power of this orchestral music juxtaposed with the tenderness of the hammer dulcimer. That was what we set out to do.
Right. The work is for hammer dulcimer strings and percussion. What kind of percussion is part of this work?
So the strings, there should be, I think, 22 strings. It's a big section. And then there are five of us percussionists. So there's myself and then four others. We have a timpanist, very active bass drum player, snare drum, various kinds of cymbals, finger cymbals, crash cymbals, suspended cymbals. And we have a fellow who's pretty much a professional marimba player, or marimbas they call them. And he and I will be featured in the third movement, which, as I mentioned earlier, is sort of the lighter movement. But, no woodwinds and no brass, just because we wanted to focus on those two sections. Next year when we start creating new pieces, we'll incorporate for full orchestra. But we guarantee that if you come to the concert, you're going to hear timbres and treatments of these hymns that you've never heard before, because it's just rare to hear a dulcimer in this context.
Mm. Tell us about your collaboration with Ron Arden, the conductor of the Lake County Symphony Orchestra. He, as you mentioned, heard you perform, and that's what precipitated him to seek you out to be composer in residence for the group. Have you collaborated, you and he, in the construction of this work, or did he, in a sense, trust you to just put something together that he was thrilled to play?
Well, I guess we started, as I said, you know, last Christmas Eve. He called, you know, a few days later when we put the recording live, because he had heard it live, and then he heard it again, reflected on it. And in February said, you know, why don't we explore doing more than just that opening piece? So at the concert, I will open it with this 6.5-minute piece that's just hammered dulcimer, and then we bring on the concerto after that. I sent him the first movement, which was, you mentioned, is God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, and he said, you know, this is exactly what I'm looking for. Let's find something that people don't know as much. Of course, people know that song, so they should be drawn into it. The second movement is based on Gustav Holst's Lule My Liking. So if you're listening in out there in radio land and you haven't heard that piece, Google it, and I think you'll see it. It's really a very cool melody. And so we wrote something sort of mysterious for that. And so all through the process, Ron was listening and reviewing and making suggestions. You know, he's the full-time musician. I should be candid and honest there. And so with him and Joshua Messick, and I'm, you know, managing portfolios in the daytime, both of them were just super helpful in developing this piece over the, you know, the spring months and summer months, and here we are in December and ready to premiere it.
As I scanned the full score that you sent me a link to it, I was noticing that rhythmically this is not always that simple and straightforward a work. I know there's at least one passage that is in something like 7/8 or 7/16 or something like that, or I mean a somewhat uncommon time signature, if I remember correctly. Can you just say a word about what you have done to try to make this a rhythmically interesting piece?
Yes. Again, being a percussionist and being raised in the progressive rock era, I was very interested in groups like Yes, Gentle Giant, Genesis, Jethro Tull, who would use odd time signatures to present their music, but they did it in such a way that you didn't really know that you were listening in 7/8 or 5/4. And so I tried to take that same concept, make it interesting for the listener, but not something where they would just say, oh gosh, this just doesn't really feel rooted, you know, because 4/4 time is what we're mostly used to listening to. But the second movement is indeed in 7/16, 7/8, and 7/4, and it stays in that throughout the piece. But the hope is that people hear, wow, this is different and fresh, rather than, you know, focusing on the number of beats in the measure.
Right. No, absolutely. Actually, as I listened to it, it didn't particularly jump out at me, and then I'm looking at it and realizing, oh my gosh, that's really cool, and it's neat that it sounds as natural as it does. So we are recording this interview first thing Monday morning, and the concert is Saturday night. So have you yet had a chance to rehearse this piece with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra, or is that pleasure still to come?
Well, that pleasure is still to come, and it starts Thursday night. So we have a 3-hour rehearsal this coming Thursday night, the 6th. Friday the 7th is the dress rehearsal. And we're excited to tell your listeners that on Saturday, even though the concert begins at 7:30, we have a pre-concert lecture, or in our case, we're calling it a pre-concert conversation. Ron and I will be up there talking about how the piece was created. I'll be on my instrument, and people that are attending that conversation will be able to come up to the stage and actually strike the instrument and make some sounds themselves if they wish to do so. Of course, you don't have to, but we just want people to be drawn into this experience and feel like it's, you know, something that is fresh and unique to their Christmas in 2018.
Fantastic. By the way, I mentioned, I think, earlier that your stint as composer in residence with the Lake County Symphony Orchestra extends well beyond this concert all the way into the year 2022. So have you and Ron Arden talked about what some of your other projects with the symphony might be?
Yes, we have, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So as I mentioned much earlier, I performed at Carnegie Hall in 1972. So in 2022, the goal is to go back on the 50th anniversary of that and take an ensemble and play some of the works that we're going to create now over the next 4 years. Specifically, they've asked me to produce two concerti, a requiem, which will involve choruses from around the area, and then my first symphony probably in 2022. Some of these pieces will include the hammered dulcimer, but some of them will just be for the standard orchestration of the symphony orchestra.
Very good. We want to mention also for this concert coming up on Saturday night that also on the program is a wonderful fresh treatment of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker by the great Duke Ellington called Nutcracker Suites, which is also part of this concert Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. at Village Church down in Gurnee at 1319 Hunt Club Road. And if you want more information about Saturday night's concert, you can go to the website of the orchestra, which is lakecountysymphonyorchestra.com, or you can call them at 847-746-3472. And again, Saturday night's concert will include the world premiere of the Christmas Concerto for Hammered Dulcimer, Strings, and Percussion by Charles Brown. Charles Brown, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you today on the morning show. Very best wishes to you and all of the fine musicians of the Lake County Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you so much, Greg. Really appreciate it. Merry Christmas.
We finish out today's morning show by playing an excerpt from an interview a number of years ago, which I did with Charles D. Cohen, the author of a book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel, published by Random House. In the book, Charles Cohen explores the varied career of Theodore Geisel, who of course went on to become one of the best known and most admired authors of children's books in history. One of the most interesting things which Charles Cohen does in his book is trace the development of certain iconic Dr. Seuss stories, like Horton Hatches the Egg.
It's a great story. People would ask him, of course, how he came up with his ideas, and one of the ones he told was about Horton Hatches the Egg. And he varied it over 30, 35 years, which was the first thing that led me to believe that it probably wasn't exactly the truth. Again, he's a wonderful storyteller, and he enjoyed that more than he enjoyed the truth often. So the basic story was that he had a sketch of an elephant, a sketch of a tree, and what he told his biographers in 1995, who were friends of his for 30 years and enjoyed hearing his stories, Judith and Neil Morgan, that he told them that he left the window open, went out for a walk on the day after New Year's in 1940, and then when he came back, the wind had blown one sketch on top of the other, and he came back and saw the elephant in the tree, and bingo, he's got this great idea. But if you do the research and say, well, wait a minute, there are a lot of versions. Let me track down the facts of this story. Go to the New York Times and find out that actually the temperature that day was -5 degrees with the wind chill outside his apartment. It's not window up and go for a walk weather. And he had told that same anecdote several years earlier, and it was happening in the spring, summer area. So it's a lot of fun to go through first and find out, okay, that isn't true. So now what really did happen? And that particular story developed over a 10-year period, and we try to show through some of the 700 images that we have in this book the progression, the way he would work with different animals out of context, a whale up in a tree or different animals with eggs. You get to the point where at one point you have an elephant on an egg and it just smashes it. 2 years before the book actually came out, he did a story called Matilda, the Elephant with a Mother Complex, and it's the exact same story that we're familiar with, of the elephant and the bird flying off and the elephant trying to hatch the egg, but has the exact opposite outcome. In the end, they think Matilda's an idiot for trying to hatch this egg. The bird flies off with no gratitude, the child, that is. So you can see that no matter what he told as the story, it's very clear that he was working and honing and changing this idea until he got to the great story we now remember.
It's good that you give us that
fable, Matilda the Elephant with a Mother Complex, in its entirety. I mean, it's actually mostly text with really just two illustrations and then a moral at the very end of it. Moral, don't go around hatching other folks' eggs.
It's great to be speaking with someone, by the way, who has seen the book since it comes out today. It's wonderful that someone's been able to already read some and hopefully enjoy it.
Oh, it's a sheer delight. It really, really is. And it is really, in particular, so fun to see the evolution of certain ideas when all we know is the finished form,
exactly. You
know, the book which ended up in our hands as youngsters, to see the twists and turns that the story took as it evolved over time. You've done all of us a real service here.
Thank you. And what you were saying about the pleasure of being able to see the whole piece, I think that's important if you're really going to get an understanding. And you know, the book itself, when you're dealing with a biography, tends to be geared above the average child's interest, although he, as an author, is of interest to children. So I wanted to have things that people could read to kids, like that story, or later in the book, the other one that we were able to publish in its entirety that people wouldn't be familiar with is called Speedy Boy. And we published portions of other really fun stories that people have forgotten about because they were never published again in books. There's a story called Tad and Todd about identical twins. Some of them are just marvelous, and I really felt this as we got into all the research and things for the book. It was this feeling of responsibility that came up to not let these things be lost to time.
We're speaking with Charles D. Cohen, and we're talking about his book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. You, at some point in the book, take great pains to say that this is not a thorough biography of Theodore Geisel, and yet you do give us some helpful background information on who he was, his family, where he grew up, and in particular, I found interesting the influence which perhaps played on his young creative mind by a certain children's author whose books he apparently read, with the last name of Belloc, B-E-L-L-O-C. I didn't know this name. But when I read Dr. Seuss, I just think there's never been anybody like Dr. Seuss before, but indeed there sort of was.
Well, I wouldn't say that Belloc was a predecessor of that ilk. I think you'd find Charles Lutwidge Dodson, or Lewis Carroll, rather, would be more of the type of predecessor people would recognize. But he took things from different authors because he had this really peculiar memory. He couldn't forget certain things, particularly images. So with the Belloc books, it wasn't so much the text, which was more of a moralistic teach kids to behave sort of thing, but he remembered the images that Basil Blackwood, or BTB is the artist that did those, he remembered those images. I think you probably remember the images of the goat on atop the mountain. It was just a throwaway image. I have no idea why that stuck with him, but he reproduces that throughout his entire life, and there's probably 50 examples of it.
Hmm. When I was thinking, too, you mentioned the fact that Belloc liked to often make up
yes.
names or words in order to finish out a rhyme.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, that's also a familiar hallmark of a lot of Dr. Seuss's works.
Yes, clearly. He absorbed all of these things, as well as from other children's authors. Peter Newell, who did the whole book, for example, he got a certain playfulness out of them, and he did learn things like creating words, obviously. But I think you'd agree, he took it to a whole different level when he
right. well,
his
and,
own work.
Well, and you say that he sort of rebelled against the what you call kind of the puritanical tone of a lot of that children's literature. I mean, he might have taken visual images or certain styles of writing from it, but then it was towards the end of a wholly different and refreshing sort of moral or point to the story.
Yes, clearly. As a matter of fact, I've learned that in England and in Canada in particular, Dr. Seuss has sort of this anarchic persona. People really like this countercultural sort of feel that they get from him. And at first, I thought it might just have to do with a character like the Cat in the Hat, who isn't your traditional character, allows people to mess up a house rather than teaching them to keep it clean. But it was more than that. When you look at it, it fundamentally, he has this slightly anti-authoritarian influence where any character in power, whether it be a teacher or particularly any ruler, a king, whether it's the Kingdom of Did or whether it's Yertl as, even as a non-human ruler, they're either idiots or they're incompetent, and it takes a kid to come along and show them the right way, show them how things should be done. I think that people appreciate that part of it as being a different take, a refreshing take, and a more normal take. I mean, the Dick and Jane series that people are used to reading back at that time, they're like sickly sweet kids. Nobody's like that. So you get a whole different sort of version. And then, again, the types of things he's teaching them, once he gets their attention to the idea of tolerance, that the person's a person no matter how small, that it doesn't matter if you have a star on your belly or not, that we should be tolerant and fight against prejudice. What more important things for the fate of the world, if you will, would you want to teach a child?
Charles D. Cohen, his fascinating book is called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. I'm Gregory Berg.